This is a production of Cornell University.
Thanks, Jackie. All right, everybody, we're going to go ahead and get started. Sorry, we're a few minutes late because I was running around talking. Like I said, go ahead, grab your food, take your seats and everything. But I would like to call the meeting to order. And hey, if you'll take roll call, please.
Yeah. Adam Howell. Christy Mahoney is here. Brandon Fortenberry is online. Kate Suffron is not here. Tarek Shams is not here. Karen Leparco
is not here.
Anthony McCabe is here. Hey, I'm here. David Heiner is on vacation. Ellen Miller is here. Christopher Barth is here. Craig is not here. Marcy Benda.
I don't see her.
Jennifer Michael is here. Andrea is not here. Rigel is here. Laura Taylor.
She's here.
Here. Jessica Withers here. Herb Sheldon is not here. Andrew Brooks is here. Carrie Sanzone is online. Brian Goodell is here. Saw him earlier. Joshua Cooley is here. Jackie's here. Ashley Miller is here. Mary Newhart.
Mary's here.
Here. Emily Ivory.
I don't see her.
Here. Rob Michael is here. Jamie is here. Jessica Townley.
She would be online.
Jessica Townley, let me check online.
I don't see her online.
Susan Perry is here. Okay, great. That is roll call.
All right, thank you very much. Before I ask for approval of minutes, I want to thank everybody, any guests who are online joining us, and anybody in the room today. Thank you all for joining us. Real quick, actually, can I get a motion to approve the minutes? All right, and the minutes are approved. Okay, so we have, obviously, an action-packed agenda today. I'm looking forward to it. It should be a really fun meeting here today. Please ask questions and give your comments and lean into it, because we're gonna be going over a lot of stuff. The first thing today that we're gonna be attending to will be Employee Assembly Resolution Number 4, which is an amendment to the Employee Assembly Charter, expanding membership to include a seat for a representative from Cornell Tech. I will just make a few brief comments on this, and then turn it over to Jessica, who is a co-sponsor on the resolution. I'm really excited about this. You can add Andrea to the role. I'm really excited about this because this is a unique intersection of opportunity and interest and our ability to really extend our values towards shared government to our friends and colleagues at Cornell Tech. There has been interest for quite some time with regards to adding a representative from Cornell Tech to the Employee Assembly. However, like I said, the opportunity wasn't there because the university bylaws did not, for the purposes of shared governance, include Cornell Tech staff as part of the community that could participate in shared governance. That recently changed with the updating of the university bylaws through the campus constituency elected trustee process. So it is kind of a lucky happenstance that hurdle is now behind us. We've been able to be in communication with staff over at Cornell Tech. I've had the opportunity to speak with them, both several members of their staff individually and at a HR meeting. And there is a lot of enthusiasm to join our organization. It follows with the principles of One Cornell. I think that the modern footprint of the institution really extends beyond the campus here, as we know from Jessica being our Geneva member, from Carrie being a member who joins us remotely. So there shouldn't be any logistical problems, and philosophically it's a great opportunity. So I just want to say I would like to thank everybody at Cornell Tech that we've worked with. To to get this going. If you'll notice in the packet, there is a letter requesting representation from Cornell Tech on the employee assembly. And with that, I'll turn it over to Jessica. Do you have anything to add? Or? Just as a quick reminder, do you know where the microphones are?
Oh, I think there's one by Josh.
Just because we anticipate possibly having a lot of people joining us online, there are microphones. If we could try to use those or pass them down whenever. No problem. I know that there might be some people from Cornell Tech joining us. If there's anybody at Cornell Tech who would like to say a few words, you're more than welcome to, before I open the floor for questions, comments, or anything else. Okay, and if not, the floor is open for comments, questions. Yes, Erin. It will, and that's a good point that I meant to mention and forgot. The seat will be part of the spring election, and it will be, because our seats are meant to be staggered, to where half of the seats are up for election any given year, but right now that has not been the effective practice. We're going to actually have that seat be a three-year term to start, so that it will, they'll run for election this spring, but they will align with the staggered terms, so that we're not, right now there's a lot of people running in the spring, and that's not the intent, so we want to stagger these things.
I'll hang up on that. Mm-hmm. The Cornell Tech employees, can they also vote on the at-large candidates?
They have all the same rights and privileges as any member. Is
right. This hasn't been approved yet.
So oh, yeah.
If it gets approved in time, then we'll add it.
The lines that will be amended are spelled out in the whereas clauses, and we'll make sure to update those documents if this passes. Anyone else? If not.
I have a quick question. I think Marin is on, and is she from Cornell Tech?
I believe so.
So I just want to ask Marin, what has the feedback been from her side of the Cornell community in regards to representation on the EA? Has there been a real resurgence of requests for this? Are people concerned about representation? What is the general consensus from that corner of Cornell?
I hope everyone can hear me. I don't want to speak for all of my colleagues, obviously. I can only speak to my perception of my conversations with other Cornell Tech staff and our community at Cornell Tech. But the conversation about representation within the larger university community and also just kind of becoming a little bit more of a part of the broader Cornell the broader One Cornell initiative has been something that's come up repeatedly over the course of my months that I've been here. I transitioned to Cornell Tech from the Ithaca campus in July, and I very rapidly picked up on those conversations. So I can say that there definitely has been sort of a push to want to integrate a little bit more into the broader Cornell staff community. Does that answer the question?
It does.
I know it may... It may break up the flow of things a little bit, but if because of the acoustics and everything like that, if when you're speaking, we'll have to pass down the mic on each row because our friends online aren't able to hear as well. So are there any other questions or comments? And if not, I'll entertain a motion to approve resolution 4.
This is Terry. I have one quick question.
Okay.
Do we have a number for the constituency? How many people would be added by representing Cornell Tech?
I don't, but Marin, would you be able to tell us the staff footprint? I have an idea in my mind, but I don't want to give a bad number. Ballpark, Marin, can you tell us about the staff footprint at Cornell Tech?
Yeah, I think Julie Jolie would have a better number, but from what I understand, I think there's maybe between 60 and 70 of us. I might be coming in significantly lower, because I know we are constantly growing and shifting and changing.
Carrie, I can follow up with their HR and get you that number, the exact number at a later time, if that's all right.
Awesome, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? If not, Brian has made a motion to approve Resolution 4. Do I have a second? Second from Rigel. All those in favor, just raise your placards. All right. Any opposed? And abstentions? Okay. Seeing no opposition, the resolution is approved unanimously by the EA. Congratulations to everybody at Cornell Tech and welcome. Or food welcome. Thank you. Okay. Moving on, I'll turn to Jessica, who's going to present the spring elections plan for approval by the EA.
Yeah, So in your packet is some information about the spring elections. We have to run this by the full EA for approval. The first page you'll see is a color spreadsheet of the seats that are up for election this year. And then the remaining are anyone who is not up for election this year is automatically on the elections committee. So we're at the bottom there. But just take this as the reminder that for those of you who are up for election that you'll be having to make that decision. And you can see that the spread is not even as it was intended. Right now there are 18 seats up for election this spring and 11 that are not up for election. So adding the Cornell Tech to the to expire in 2021 will just help balance that out a little bit. The four at-large seats are not chartered, so those end this year and will not be filled. After that, you'll see that we have a proposed timeline. We came up with this after discussion with the executive committee and with Gina. Basically, we're going to be running through April and just meeting our deadline of May 1st. And I wrote it as a list and also put in a screenshot of the calendar there just for the visual people. After that, the publicity plan. Again, we talked about this with the executive committee, and we have a proposal there. It's pretty standard. We would like to tie in with the idea of the Cornell Employee Club, if that does work out. And then afterwards are the election rules. And this is where Mary was pointing out that Tech is not on here. That's because when we edited these, the resolution had not yet been approved. Basically, these are the rules from last year. We just updated dates. And links won't work if you happen to be looking at a digital copy. But again, it's basically the same thing that's been done in the past. It's all pretty standard. So I'm not sure how officially we get approval, but that's what we're here for, the election committee, hoping that you'll all agree that we should go forth and meet these.
So per our bylaws, it is the full EA that votes on an approval of the election plan. For right now, I'm happy to open the floor for questions or comments to Jessica. Again, I know I might slow things down, but try to use the microphones, pass them down, and as people have questions. And are there any questions, comments, concerns, anything like that for Jessica? Ellen. I know it's gonna.
At-large seats. There's four people filling those seats right now. There's, if everyone were to be reelected in their current roles, if that's what they're interested in doing, we obviously don't have enough seats to accommodate everyone. Is there an option of adding additional at-large seats if they should be needed in the next term?
I don't know because I wasn't here when these at-large seats were added. I'm not clear how that all happened. If anyone, do you know
anything?
Can we ask Gina for some historical background?
We can. I can say that any change to there are two options. If according to the bylaws, if people if there are vacancies left on the agenda or left on the EA after the election. If I'm not mistaken, it moves to those people who ran for seats but did not make it on. They are opened up to those vacancies that they may qualify for. I know that doesn't fully answer your question, but it could come into play. I believe that what you're suggesting would have to require a bylaw change. Gina, if you're monitoring, if you can provide any background to the at-large seats, we would love some.
I think there's two questions really that you have to answer. One is the assembly adopted a representative model to replace at-large seats. So adding these at-large seats were added by the assemblies during the term, but as Adam just said, if you wanted to add at-large seats, it would require a bylaw change. There was not. They were parsed over two different periods, two different terms. The seats that Carrie holds, and I don't have my list in front of me right now. Two terms ago, they were added, and I'd have to go back to read the transcript for the particular reason, but. The numbers that were most recently added as at-large numbers used the precedent from the prior year to add those, and so it just has sort of compounded a very it's not messy, it's just it's ad hoc, and so in an effort to realign with the charter and the bylaws according to the numbers and the seats, the at-large members are not currently included in either the charter or the bylaws. So Jessica's plan is for those members that are chartered as who would be voting members of the assembly.
Any other questions? Jeremy.
Just going back to historical reference, and Gina can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that we originally had two of those seats available back from when we were only endowed or non-endowed. That was the only distinction of seats at the EA. There was a conscious effort to be more representative of our staff and a development of that over a couple of years to what we have now, which is representatives from different areas across campus. Those seats are kind of a holdover of that, because we wanted to be sure to include as many staff as were interested in being involved in the EA, and there weren't then always a place defined for them. So one of the things that I would think about is, particularly as the EA has become larger, and we're still, same goal, want staff involvement as much as possible. What does that mean for voting representative seats? What does that mean for additional access to your committees? Do we encourage staff to be involved that way? It's really a question of, this is a model that's been developing over a number of years, and this is where we're at currently. We need to continue thinking about who the EA is and who they want to be in the future.
Thank you. Other questions? Just 1 second, Gina. Jessica has a question online.
Yep.
Or no, that's Carrie. I'm sorry. I can say unofficially that when those at-large seats were added, mine in particular, it was because we had an overflow of candidates for certain seats and long-time vacancies in others. But as we've been successful in filling seats, yay, it made things messier. Thanks, Carrie. Gina, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to follow up. Jeremy's quite right. It was actually exempt and non-exempt were the distinction. So, and then a representative from Geneva. So the assembly was much smaller, and you were an at-large member either as an exempt employee or a non-exempt employee. And very, very little opportunity for direct representation. So as Jeremy just said, over the course of 3 years, the idea evolved to what the assembly is now, a representative model. There are still seats, one for an exempt at-large and one for a non-exempt at-large. So those were specifically included, but the sort of ad hoc at-large members that didn't fit the equation but still wanted to run and were included is sort of where we are right now. So there is great rich history, and I think as Jeremy indicated too, that it's there's a probably a larger question here as the assembly is growing and who it represents. There are some seats that are other areas of the university in Ithaca that are not represented directly that have asked for that representation. So there's just a lot of good questions to have the assembly take under consideration.
I'll add that there's also, someone suggested, I think Ann did months ago, to look into a 15-plus year seat to align with a 5-year. And we, now that election season's on us, I don't feel that the election committee has the bandwidth to take that on, but this is all good stuff that might be useful for next year's election committee.
Other questions? Chris, can we pass the mic down to Chris?
Is the question that we need to answer that on the spreadsheet, the four representatives at large in gray are not chartered, so thus functionally expire at the end of this election, and that we would need to add into the charter that we're going to have these four at-large seats that are not, like, dedicated to anything. Because, in my opinion, we're the best EA that we've ever been. I've only been here for 2 years, but it seems like we've, you know, we're all happy that we're getting more and more people with more and more opinions and more hands make light work. So if the question is, do these gray seats by the rules basically expire? And so if you can answer that question, and then I got more
I believe they do expire. That is my understanding through Gina and the history that I've heard.
Okay.
This year.
So then our considerations for everybody that is on the EA is there any strength to being smaller? You know, can we get things done faster? Is there a better, you know, more attention to focus? But Yeah, we've got a really large campus, and we're, you know, we're in the process of expanding even further. Like, we were all happy that we got a seat at Geneva. We just voted that we expanded to Cornell Tech campus, who is at least virtually connected to us. So what I, you know, personally, my feelings would be that we do add into the charter these four at-large seats, and possibly make it five, just so, like, whoever else is there that comes along, and then continue to see how it works out. And then if we run into a problem with, oh no, this is so bad, everybody wants to help, then we can make another decision. But it doesn't seem like a realistic problem. So I guess anybody else who has been around, and maybe Brian was there, we were just talking about it this morning, like, what was the difference between the employee assemblies in the 90s versus the employee assemblies here in 2020? And it was a smaller group of people, but I'm not sure if more got done or less got done, or yeah, how overall did it feel? So you're on the spot now.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that. So I think that a lot got done. It was half the size, but a lot got done. And but we always wanted more because the committee structures wasn't as many. It wasn't as much participation. So it's nice that we have a large group to pull from. Let's face it, all of us being on committees makes those committees stronger. And I think that's a benefit as well. So I'm not opposed to making it larger. I am opposed to making it superseding its goal of being too large. So we got to be careful of that. You also got to think about if everyone gets the cookie, then it isn't as much. It isn't as worth having as it would be if only a few people get it. So sometimes with robust elections and one person gets a seat, yeah, it's sad that not everybody can. But it's also good for democracy. So I worry about that as well. But I do think that this committee right now, the EA is a great size, perfect size at the moment. And I've seen a lot of things get done, especially in a couple of committees I've been on. I'm seeing things get carried through and following up. So I think it's kind of cool.
Okay. One thing I'll mention is that we're talking about two kind of separate but very related tracks. This being the elections plan for how the EA is structured today. I think that there has been a lot of really good conversation and a lot of very interesting questions about the nature, makeup, and size of the EA that probably should be looked at. Those will involve charter and bylaw changes. Which means this plan is for this makeup, but I would encourage, whether it's this year or the elections committee next year, to, you know, take a look at these very interesting issues, like, you know, having a 15-year plus or long serving member representative or at large seats or things like that. For my part, I think that it's important that we follow the rules as they are written now, so that everybody has a equal understanding and equal opportunity, and I think that I just want to also, at the tail end of my comments, commend Jessica and her committee, who have done an amazing job. It really shows why we need a functioning, very effective elections committee, because we have a lot of interest this year and a lot of members who are interested in serving. So. Now and beyond, and potentially more out there. So thank you, Jessica, no matter what, on your extraordinary work. And that's all. Are there other questions? If not, I would make a motion to approve this plan. Is there a second? Second by Rob. All those in favor of the elections plan, approving the elections plan as proposed by the committee, please raise your placards. Yeah, I saw that. Any abstentions or opposition? And for those online, I think, is it just Carrie? Oh, and Brandon.
Jessica is in
favor. Jessica's online.
Carrie's in favor. We're waiting for Brandon. Brandon, can you submit your vote in the chat, please? There.
Okay. And your plan is unanimously approved. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone.
Can you ask Brandon if you can hear me?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Okay.
The microphone's also late.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just going to grab it because I got to present the next one. Sorry about the audio issues, everybody. It's just, it's an ongoing struggle. We're going to be a game show host right now here. Okay. Hello. Okay, there we go. Moving on. Okay, so EA Resolution 5, divestment from fossil fuels in the Cornell Endowment. No doubt many of you have heard this issue picking up steam throughout the year in a variety of ways. My plan is, especially since we have so much on the agenda, I'm not going to do a lengthy presentation. I'm going to give some background, some information on this effort, both on the EA and how it relates to other things going on campus, and some of the criteria laid out by the Board of Trustees with regards to divestment. So very quickly, the concept of divestment in an endowment or in any financial system has been something that's been picking up steam over the last few years across the entire country, really. And it really relates to the idea that where our money is invested relates to not just a financial footprint, but also our values as an institution and the effect that money can have on the rest of the world. As it stands right now globally in terms of divestment, as of December 2019, 1,200 institutions have divested their financial portfolios from fossil fuels. There have been 58,000 individuals who have done so, and this has reached a level of $12 trillion in assets. If you look at the scale of interest in this as one of many tools to address climate change, especially in a business sense, it's accelerating. It's becoming a widely adopted methodology. At Cornell, this effort goes back to 2015-2016. Back at that time, all five of the constituent assemblies passed similar resolutions asking the Board of Trustees at Cornell to direct their funds managers to divest from fossil fuels in the Cornell Endowment. At that time, this was, again, more of a new issue with regards to endowments and divestment, and the board decided to lay out a plan and criteria that the campus community and the constituent assemblies must meet in order to take a look at this again. Essentially, they wanted us to meet a few criteria, and then all five of the constituent assemblies would ask for divestment as a in the current year. So I'm going to just read what the criteria that the board laid out are. Essentially, there are three points that the board wanted those of us who would ask that they divest in fossil fuels to meet. So one, that the company's actions or inactions are morally reprehensible. Two, that divestiture will likely lead to a meaningful impact towards correcting the specified harm and will not result in a disproportionate offsetting of societal consequences. And three, that the company contributes to harm so grave that it would be inconsistent with the goals and principles of the university. I can tell you all that right now, this resolution in this form has been passed by the University Assembly unanimously and by the Graduate Assembly unanimously. It is accompanied by a white paper that you all have. The full white paper is available on the box. There is a summary that you all have in your packet, and it sets out addressing those criteria specifically. This effort is intended to be constructive and deferential to the board's stewardship role with regards to the endowment. We're not setting strict deadlines. We're not picking out particular companies. We do believe, and when I say we, I want to mention that this white paper and this resolution text, this is all the extraordinary work of Professor Carolyn Levine, who has who's really taken the research end of this by the horns and dove into, again, the three criteria and putting together an enormous amount of information on why divestment is an appropriate thing for an institution such as Cornell. I will say, with regards to morally reprehensible, you'll find in the white paper that there are numerous cited examples of large fossil fuel companies having knowledge, research, and internal internal information, acknowledging climate change as a detriment, acknowledging their role in it, and then actively engaging in communications, marketing, and other strategies to subvert efforts to address it in any meaningful way. And insofar as even doubling down on their investments in certain in fossil fuel activities when they have opportunities to do otherwise, that would even make a business sense for them. That rises when you consider, in our opinion, when you consider the effects of climate change, that rises to the level of morally reprehensible when it comes down to the human impact that the future may have if we don't address this this issue. With regards to meaningful impact, correcting the specified harm and not offsetting societal consequences. First of all, with regards to meaningful impact, we know, and there is again cited evidence in the white paper, that Cornell has an opportunity to be one of the most noteworthy institutions to divest, and there is a concept called first mover concept, whereby we can have the opportunity to actually move many other institutions in a much greater way towards this goal by us being Cornell, essentially. Divestment makes these investments or these funds and these companies less stable, less attractive to other very public bodies who might have large things to invest, and can be a guiding element in their behavior, in their future behavior, as well as our peer institutions. We would be the first Ivy League institution to divest, and that would be an incredible opportunity for the university. I believe that in terms of the fractional size that has just been reported in an FAQ put out by the university, the very small size of our exposure in the endowment to the big 40, I believe, fossil fuel companies, the benefits far outweigh, in my opinion, any potential negative effects. So there's that. And then with regards to inconsistencies to the Cornell mission and values, if you'll notice, sorry, my papers are all out of order here. I've taken a couple lines from one line from the university mission, which states that Cornell aims through public service to enhance the lives and livelihoods of students and the people of New York, and others around the world. This money is going to facilitate and fund companies whose activities would be in direct contrast to that line. The future, as reported by the vast, vast majority of peer-reviewed research, indicates that there is major detrimental harm to health, safety, and property here and throughout the world if climate change and the companies that contribute to it do not abate. So that would be inconsistent with that part of the mission. And then from the core values, which I would note were just passed by the Board of Trustees, just approved by the Board of Trustees, there's a line that says respect for the natural environment. We value our role in advancing solutions for a sustainable future, and we recognize the close relationship between people and Earth, and the Earth acting in ways to live and work sustainably. I mean, I think it's self-evident that investments in fossil fuel companies are in contrast to that statement. Again, I am very happy to answer any questions. I want to mention one other thing. I personally have been volunteered, I've been involved in things like this. Most of you know that this is a big interest of mine throughout most of my life, but I've never come across an opportunity to have as great of an impact as this. The people who have, the members who have co-sponsored this resolution with me, I reached out to them directly because for one reason or another, I know that they have a certain interest or a certain, some touch point with this, but I've been happy. And we can do this even after it passes. If you would like your names to be on this, if you'd like to co-sponsor it as well, just let me know after following whatever happens here today, and I'd be happy to add your names because I personally feel like this is a really impactful opportunity. And everybody who wants to be on the EA can be a big part of it. So that's my quick presentation on the issue, but I'm happy to take any questions or if there are any comments, please go ahead. The floor is open.
say that even if from a completely selfish point of view, it seems like this is the direction things are going, and if Cornell is at the end of the divestments, they're going to be losing the most money from the endowment rather than getting out earlier. So even from like a totally not caring about the environment and only caring about the endowment and money, the earlier Cornell does this, it seems like the better, because this is happening and the country is moving, the world is moving. Seems like a great time for us to get out ahead of it and not be the ones holding the bag at the end.
Thank you. Now we will be able to.
Okay. My name is Scott Burke. I'm a constituent here. And just following up to what Adam said, 1.3% of the endowment is in fossil fuels. That's approximately $95 million that we have invested, which percentage-wise is very, very small. And then if you look at investing that in the next best opportunity, having a little bit less diversified portfolio, what does that kind of mean in terms of actual dollars that we're losing by going to a different investment as opposed to fossil fuels? And I would say that's probably in the ballpark of about $1 or $2 million if you look at the next best opportunity and you reinvest. And then if you look at the financial burden that this is having on our ability to attract new student leaders, research, and that type of long-term outlook of our university, and that financial impact is a lot more than the very, very small amount of money that we're looking at in terms of reinvesting this money in something different. If you look at the amount of student tuition, we're talking, I don't know, maybe less than 50 students or something like that. And if we're talking about how many people are actually out there protesting and saying that the university is doing something wrong in that impact, there's a lot more than 50 students that do that a year. And that's just a constituent feedback or kind of input in this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Rob.
I just want to say thank you for all the work that's been done beforehand. I mean, I came on this at the end and Adam reached out to me and hey, and I was just proud to sort of be a co-sponsor on this and just put my name on it because the work's already been done and it's great work. I just want to say that in terms of a lot of the way this is always viewed is through a cost perspective, which obviously has to be taken into account. But if it would have been nice if we would have been doing these things 50 years ago when they actually knew what the problem was and we weren't facing the UN climate deadlines, the tipping points, and so on and so forth. But, you know, whenever we talk about costs, we never, you know, if in 20 or 30 years we're seeing the mass migrations, the armed conflicts, all the, you know, Australia on fire and all these other instances, are we literally going to say that we had a chance to do something and then we sacrificed it for a piece of paper? And that's essentially what it comes down to, is that as long as the fossil fuel industry has the resources to continue to explore and drill, as long as there's still profit to be made, they won't stop. So in terms of the divestment at like a $95 million level, it's small, but it sends out a message. And if the banks aren't giving money to these pipelines that are going through native territories, you know, if the insurance companies aren't insuring these pipelines, all of this falls apart. So this is our opportunity, and that's all I would say. So thank you.
Thanks, Rob. We have a comment from or a question from Carrie online. Carrie.
Hey, everybody. Recognizing that I may be in the minority here, I'm conflicted about this. Sorry, I have some notes. I'm conflicted about this because I know it's well-intentioned, and I can see the one side of this that you've all laid out really well. But at the same time, it's murky to me, the idea of divestment from fossil fuels, because so many ginormous companies wouldn't exist
without the direct impetus from fossil fuels. I mean, if you think about it, Pepsi, Coke, bottling companies, bottled water, Amazon would not exist in its current form if it didn't have the global sort of e-commerce and shipping that creates all kinds of emissions, I imagine. And so I guess I'm just conflicted about when we say fossil fuels, there's the source, but then we're all consumers of it. And the companies that we use, the products that we use, the things that we do every day are all relying on fossil fuels. So it just, at best, it seems, it just seems a little bit disingenuous to say we're divesting from fossil fuels when in reality so much other business is powered by that. And I guess on a morally reprehensible angle, I guess I sort of make a distinction between an individual company that may have acted unethically or reprehensibly versus an entire sector. So I guess, and my last point is, we have a whole office that, you know, staff members who work for the investment office who, that's their job, is to care for, care and feeding of the endowment. And so I guess I'm just, I wish we could hear from some of them, but I guess I'll just say it's murky for me. I'm conflicted about it.
Anyone else? Rob? Yeah, you're good.
In terms of some of Gary's points, in terms of the jobs, I think, you know, that's often an argument that's put out there, is that there'll be a loss of employment. I'm not sure in terms of how it would affect this divestment discussion, just in terms of the investment office would basically just switch to looking for other funds to invest in. So I don't think there would be any impact. But in terms of, in talking about like coal miners and other things, I mean, any move to a Green New Deal, as it were, would need to include a transition plan. The same thing for Medicare for All. You'd have to have a transition where you'd be employing people in other fields. So in terms of, that's for the jobs argument. In terms of, you know, us as individuals doing what we can, and obviously they, you know, plastic bags have been taken away at Wegmans, but everything else is wrapped in plastic and everything else, but it's all bad. It's all bad, and it was a step in terms of taking away the plastic bags. But, you know, we each can individually, you know, eat less meat or use light bulbs that were more efficient or more efficient technologies in our own lives. But I feel like that's also a fossil fuel industry talking point, is basically put the onus on individuals when they're just drill, baby, drill and just burning. So, we can all do what we can, but this is just another step in sort of the process of making the transition. And yeah.
So. Other comments?
So this resolution actually came out of the UACIC that I'm the chair of, and originally I voted against it in my own committee because, like Kerry, I had conflicts about being effective. The university looked at this and passed it through all the assemblies in 2015, and the Board of Trustees said sort of thank you, but no thank you, because we really got to keep the health of the fund, but here's this rules of and criteria of if you guys ask this question again. I did forward to our email list the Cornell Chronicle article that sort of, I guess, would say is the university's response to the divestment argument. So the university's done a whole lot of really good stuff, including our funds. You know, even yesterday in the UA with President Pollack, I said the stuff that you have in this article is things that our committees looked for and we couldn't find or get anybody to tell us. And there are things like the university is contracting with financial managers that do are called ESGs, and they're really looking at environmental and socially, I'm looking for what the name of it is. So it's not like the university hasn't been doing anything. Lots of different programs, environmental, social, and governance. The thing I was really worried about the most was being effective with this. You know, we're really kind of going to the Board of Trustees by all of us passing this resolution. And I thought there might be another way to do it without a resolution. That was really sort of, I was like, maybe I can get them at a happy hour and talk them into this or something like that. But I did vote for it last night with the idea that this is us all coming together and making an ask, making an attempt to meet the criteria. It was something that, you know, because I voted no, Adam and Caroline and the students on my committee were like, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, here are all these concerns I have about, you know, do we have to write a research paper or how are we going to meet and respond to them? Because they really thought through this and worked really hard. You know, there's a lot of them at the Board of Trustees, I think over 85, that took the serious issue very serious. And stories in the news lately about trillion-dollar investment funds like Blackstone getting out of it, the fossil fuels business is moving along. So I do support this resolution. I voted for it. I will vote for it here in the employee assembly. But I do respect that it is a complicated thing, and I encourage you to read through the white paper as well as look at what is a Chronicle article that kind of outlines a little bit more of the information. And it is okay because it's like a very complicated thing. You know, we got asked, you know, if we're going to divest from fossil fuel companies, shouldn't we like get the people that run the gas pumps? And shouldn't we go after all these different areas? And it doesn't, for me, seem like the effective. It's like start somewhere and make the ask. And so right now I'll tell you that none of the Ivy Leagues have voted for divestment, as well as I'm pretty sure none of the SUNY schools. And also the case has been made by the administration that by divesting, so getting rid of the stocks that we own, we will not have a proxy vote. So that is like the idea that, hey, we sit on here and because we own shares in this, we actually want you to go and look into reducing harm. The statistic that Caroline was able to find, not in reference to the stuff that we own specifically, was that between 1994 and 2015, 127 proxy votes were requested to fossil fuel-related companies to work on climate change, and all of them were no. The answer was no, summarily. So that's just a data point for you to think about with this argument, because it is something, too, that the Board of Trustees would say, hey, by being a part of this, we have a chance to do the influence, but it doesn't seem like that really pans out. So I definitely would like to thank Caroline and Adam for bringing this and everybody's insights, because that's the strength of the assembly. So thanks.
So this is Scott Burke, constituent again. I'm an engineer here at the university, and I work in building construction. Something a lot of people don't know about me is actually I'm also an engineer consultant at home, and I work for petroleum companies. I design mechanical components for pumps, and we're actually working on some very cutting-edge technology that is, I hope, going to affect the industry as a whole, because pumps are used for domestic water, they're used for fire, they're used for all kinds of different things. So some really high-tech, cutting-edge stuff. I also drive a fossil fuel vehicle, as I'm sure probably many people do. But this, first I want to address the proxy vote. Just if you look at it by the numbers, $95 million is how much we have in the endowment in fossil fuels. If you look at just the market capital, that's the total valuation of ExxonMobil as a corporation, it's $380 billion. So let's say we had all of our $95 million in just one company. As a proxy vote, we'd own less than 1/1,000th of that company. So if there's 1,000 people in a room and you raise your hand and you say, I don't think this is good, you really don't have a big voice as a proxy vote, especially when you discern that we're not just in one business, we're across 40 businesses. So that's 1/40,000th of a vote, of a proxy vote. So we don't really have, as Cornell, a big say with our stake in proxy voting of changing fossil fuels as an industry. And then getting back to me being a petroleum engineer and consultant, I really can't think of myself here, and I really have to see that the industry, if fossil fuels goes away, I'm still going to be an engineer, I'm still going to work on cutting edge technology. There's going to be another field out there, whether it be chemical or domestic water pumps there's going to be another field out there where I'm going to move to and then continue to use my knowledge and continue to advance society. So somebody who may lose some economic benefit personally, it's not going to be because Cornell divested or invested in fossil fuels. We really don't have enough money to sway the people I work for, Exxon, Chevron, those types of people, in a bigger stance. It's more about the university as a whole, what's right for the university. Is our 2035 carbon neutral initiative in alignment with divesting from fossil fuels? What do we want to say to our students? What do we want to say to our researchers? What do we want to say as a university? And what we believe moving forward, what we stand for. And really, the future generations of people growing up here and how plastic, how oil spills, how climate change is affecting them, and whether or not we want to hold ownership in that business. Thank you.
Is there anyone else?
Right. So where to start? So the biggest thing that I've come across is that corporations are responsible for the vast majority of carbon emissions. Consumers are a very minute minority when it comes to reducing carbon emissions, whether that's just driving your car or using plastics. Really, it comes down to the corporations. So we have to speak up and say, if we see these corporations doing a bad thing, this is our opportunity to tell them and potentially get other people to say the same thing.
For the sake of time, and unless there are a lot of other comments, I would just like to say thank you all for the debate, and especially Carrie. I appreciate your comments, perspective, and it's sometimes difficult to go against the prevailing knowledge, and that's very valuable for us for the prevailing flow of the debate. So I do appreciate that. With that, I'm not going to belabor the point anymore. I will just move the previous question. I have a second. Second from Rob. All those in favor, please raise your placards. Opposed? Abstain. And we have one opposite, with everyone else voting in favor and one opposition, the resolution passes. So thank you all very much. Okay, seeing for time, I'm going to suggest something really quick. We have a very, very important topic coming up next. If it is okay with everybody, I was going to suggest that we do committee report reports. If you could all perhaps just submit them briefly written after the meeting. If that's okay with everybody, I'd like to spend as much time as we can on the inclement weather issue. Does anybody have any opposition to that? Okay. So moving on, let's move into this is not a resolution. This is just an issue of discussion. I hope it moves forward with some serious, with a lot of people engaged in it with regards to the university handling of the recent inclement weather incidences and lake closures. So, again, this is just a very important topic, and I'll open the floor to all of you. Just takes a second.
I'm sure all of you have also heard from your constituents the amounts that the lake closing caused. And it varies a lot among offices. Some supervisors are very willing to let staff call in. Others, you have to show up.
This is off.
Okay.
There's something I can do to make it so it doesn't echo. So a couple suggestions that I heard was, and also looking at peer institutions, was to ask the university to set a time to make a decision, 5:30 a.m. for daytime closings. and activities and maybe 3 p.m. for evening. And then also the idea of a weather and safety leave. This is something the federal government does, because right now if you're an exempt employee and you stay home because of weather, you are paid. If you are not exempt and you stay home for weather, you have to use leave, which seems very unfair. So those were two of the ideas that were brought up to me.
Other questions, comments?
I was one of those people stuck on a bus who had to walk up the hill with several other staff people who couldn't not go to work because the university was open. So, you know, waiting on a TCAT bus for 40 minutes, being told TCAT wasn't going to run, and then having to walk up the hill. I saw incredible things walking up the hill. People almost getting hit by cars, people trying to push cars up Campus Road with other cars sliding down and nearly hitting them. It was frightening. And I think given the number of people who rely on the bus system to get to work, when the buses aren't running, university shouldn't be open. It really shouldn't be open.
Rigel? I think Rigel.
We had to get the car towed that day. I just want to know why the decision was made to keep the university open and why we are not considering surrounding institutions when closing a university. It seems weird when Ithaca College gets pretty similar weather that we do, why we don't think about what decisions they're making when the same weather's coming.
I'll just grab the microphone for you all.
Then Jamie after.
Adam and I had a chat with Mary Opperman, and we expressed to her a lot of the concerns that we had about the TCAT closure, about stranding a lot of individuals up on the hill for hours without any means of transportation. From our understanding, from our conversation with Mary, it sounded like they were getting weather information, and by the time they got updated weather information that would persuade them to close the university, TCAT was already closed. That was the information that I was provided. I think that judging from that scenario, there was perhaps, in my opinion, some poor judgment that was utilized. But I think that was what was communicated to us in regards to why TCAT was closed and the university was still open.
Chrissy.
So when talking about the committee, she did reference, and this is available in the FAQs of the Inclement Weather website, that there is an incident leadership team, and they are comprised of the executive vice president, vice presidents for university relations, human resources, so a slew of other individuals are on this team, and they are supposed to make a recommendation. So in terms of that process, is outlined in the Inclement Weather website.
Mm-hmm. We don't know the specifics of how the communication between that team played out that day. If that's what you're asking, how they met or anything like that, we didn't get that information. Jamie, do you have the mic?
Yeah.
Real quick, when we get Jamie, then.
So I got a lot of feedback from people at the hotel school, and one of the things, like almost all weather incidents, the impact is very disproportionate on, it seems like it's very disproportionate on harder impact on non-exempt employees, and you know, there's a lot of employees who have the ability to work from home, and a lot of departments did spread that message. But a lot of people who have to be in when the university is open, they're the ones most impacted. Plus, parents, when all the schools are closed, and now they have to scramble for childcare. And so again, it's these kind of cascading difficulties that compound to make it an even worse situation than just not being able to get to work or having trouble getting to work. But it's all these other things that spiral out. I had a coworker who they had childcare for their kid until that place decided to close, and so then they had to rush to Cortland to go pick up their kids and get them home. All these things, you know, the idea that Cornell's incident management team, whether they didn't have the up-to-date information, like, it's a joke that they could have less good information than Ithaca College, TC3, like all these other places in the area. I don't think that that's an acceptable response, and I do hope that we can come up with some good wording for a resolution.
Christy, and then back, and then
Dave. Brandon and Carrie, yeah. Online.
Okay, Brandon, and then Carrie.
Okay, am I next?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, so just some things that, I sit on the emergency support function team, which is a group of people who manage and talk about emergency support across the campus, and weather's obviously a big part of it. I think, you know, to answer from my lens, one of the big factors that could weigh in the decision of closing is about the rate of snow and the amount of snow that the team here can clear. So you may have seen the article from Rick Burgess noting sort of the rate of snow and how much can be cleared. And while I appreciate and understand that that's important for them to weigh in, to everyone's point, one of the things that I don't think is weighed in the level that it should be is that, yes, great, Cornell has a really amazing and strong facilities team that can do amazing thing and move mountains of snow. That doesn't always weigh out, as you see, the second you get beyond the line of the Cornell property, things quickly shift in different directions depending on which way you're going. So I think that's one of the things that often isn't weighed in. There's a lot of financial implications that I think, you know, I understand that they have to make, but I do think that an understanding of the clarity on what that is and how that's weighed into the decision-making process is important. You know, I represent a community that is, many of which are considered essential employees, which itself is a bit of a non-real sort of thing. There's no actual essential, like I can't be docked because I didn't come into work. But we are a group of people who have to come in and serve the students because the students have to have food, and we have to have a number of things available for them. So it's a challenging situation for my constituents to be considered essential if they have to come in. And then when the university doesn't close for that time frame, which they didn't, those who did make it in, they then, you know, got the benefit of beyond noon getting an extra pay. And before noon, they get the regular pay, and those who didn't come in, they don't get paid. It was a very convoluted and strange decision that I voiced as well, and everyone has voiced in a wide variety of reasons. But I think that ultimately, I would urge that we as the employee assembly should advocate for a better transparency and understanding of that decision-making process and the ability to discuss that process with our constituents, those conversations that are had with the IMT and the ILT, so that we're able to weigh in. Because that group may make decisions that don't line up with what's happening outside of the Cornell University environment, and that's what we, as the employee assembly, represent. A large number of our constituents are not in Ithaca, New York. They come from out of town in areas where they were greater impacted. So that's my input on that. Thank you.
Carrie.
Yeah, just to piggyback on what Brandon said, I feel like it's really important moving forward to make sure that the criteria used goes beyond just the immediate campus, because like Brandon said, you get off campus and things are very different. So that's a credit to the facilities team for sure, but they're just, we are a residential campus, but there are so many staff coming to campus. And we saw comments from people who are event managers that, you know, they showed up because the university was technically open, but they couldn't even hold their events because their guest speakers couldn't make it to campus, the visitors couldn't make it to campus. And so it ends up being, you know, for those folks, pointless, and a lot of extra work and worry and concern for what amounted to a very short day. So what I wanted to say was, I understand that some people drive in from a long ways away. You know, I worked with a staff member who drove over an hour for a long time from Syracuse. And so I do understand that we can't necessarily make decisions about the campus based on such outlying areas. But what we really were lacking, I think, is proactive communication. And we have seen, I don't know why it didn't happen this time, but we have seen several times that even if the university didn't close or had no intention of closing, a message the night before to say, hey, we know there may be a weather event occurring, the forecast for tomorrow is bad, we're still open, but just know that we're monitoring this, that serves some important functions, not the least of which is being a catalyst for a conversation between the supervisor and their staff members. You know, just to create the conditions where the supervisor gets reminded to say, oh, hey, you know, if your roads are really bad, here's, you know, let me know, or you don't need to come in, or let's decide who all is it will have the easiest time coming in. Whatever that may look like, it's that sort of reminder to get that conversation going if it hasn't already happened. And I'm, you know, in my department, I'm very lucky. My supervisor doesn't need that kind of reminder. But I think a lot of people are in a different situation, and so I think proactive communication is really critical. I'm in support of trying to get to more predictable timing for decisions that allow people to know for sure whether they need to come in way earlier than this time. I also wanted to just summarize some of the other feedback that we've gotten. I would love to know if there is actually a business reason for canceling classes but keeping the university open. Because we heard from some people that when classes are canceled, they have way fewer people in the eateries, way fewer people coming into the office for support. Obviously, the classes themselves aren't being run. And so I'm wondering if there is actually a reason to cancel classes but remain open. But that communication that canceled the classes but didn't acknowledge the staff really at all, and I feel like that, and we've heard from several people, that creates the perception that the staff are not as important as some other constituent groups, that they're not valued, that their safety is not a priority. And I don't think that that's what the university wants. I don't think that that's what they think, or I hope not. But that is the perception it creates when that message came out about classes. You know, it's sort of like, so it's bad enough that students and faculty shouldn't be coming in, but the staff still should, or the staff should stay on campus. So, anyway, I have a lot of thoughts, and I want to just say Jamie did a great job collecting feedback from his group. I've been trying to collect it all as it comes in so we can keep track of it, but I'm definitely interested in doing some sort of statement, resolution, whatever we can come up with. So anybody that wants to work together, let me know.
Okay, I'm going to ask for a motion to extend the meeting just by 5 minutes to get a couple more people who've asked to speak in, and then we'll end. Can I have a motion to do that? Hey, and Rigel. Rigel, go ahead.
Carrie, I think you summed it up really well, especially with people that came in from farther away than just living in Ithaca. Maybe it would be nice to come up with some sort of reporting system for students to let them know, like, we're anticipating these weather conditions. They may, you know, reduce the operating abilities of certain facilities around campus, and then just, you know, keeping them updated throughout the day while the weather is bearing down on us, as to what capacity these facilities are operating on. It just seems, you know, like you said, with communication, it's, you know, I feel like it's very lacking as a whole, regardless of, you know,
they just come out and say, okay, classes are canceled, you know, the whole university's closed, but if we're worried about, you know, people coming in and these facilities being operating and, you know, these essential employees coming in, if they can't make it, maybe it'd be best to let people know, okay, what people didn't come in, what operating status are we in right now?
Brian?
Piggybacking on what Kara said, I'd be interested in working with you on coming up with an alternative or something. I'm concerned with better transparency. Also concerned with the criteria. There's like a bunch of different things that we can use for criteria, weather predictions, staff welfare, schools open or closed, law enforcement if the roads are closed, impact awareness, transportation and TCAT, if they're going to remain open. I think all those parties got to come together. It shouldn't be an internal decision. It should be external as well because of extending in certain senses outside the Cornell. I know that my group came in at 5 in the morning. It was beautiful. No problem at all. And we would have appreciated working Clarendon Snow if the university was closed. It would have made it a lot easier on us. The minute this building got full, I work right here, with staff and students, it was a lot harder to do our job. But then they closed schools, guess where they all stayed? They still stayed here. We were still packed, and we couldn't do the job. So it really made it difficult. So I think that there's got to be better transparency and a new criteria for so people know what would happen to trigger, hey, there might not be no school tomorrow or no university tomorrow or whatever. That's just my thoughts. I know that I will, my hat's off to the facilities group and my team and the teams across campus that did brave the elements and come in. My sadness, well, when they tried to get out of here, they couldn't. That's the sad part. We have an obligation as employers to look out for our staff, and I don't know if Cornell did it, and I don't know if they feel it. So that's my only concern.
All right. Josh, then we'll have to close up. Oh, yeah, you can use the mic. That's it. Thanks.
Was there any admittance of a mistake on their part?
I have not heard any from anyone, as far as I know.
Christy?
I would suggest we talk to a Senate representative.
Okay, just to wrap it up, I think that's a good idea, Christy. I think that there are a lot of people across all the constituencies who are upset about this issue, and this isn't the end. Please, coordinate. Those of you who are interested in working on something, I think that this is a perfect issue for us to make a strong statement on and to do some background and to try to find some sort of a resolution, some sort of a way forward so that this doesn't happen again and maybe there's an acknowledgement that there's a problem that needs to be looked at. With that, I would ask for a motion to adjourn. Andrea, second by Laura. All right, thank you very much. See you next time.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.